Welcome to our second live Q&A session of the day. Dr. Beth Erickson will moderate the questions that came in for the prostate, sarcomas, and gynecologic sessions.
Good afternoon. Those were wonderful lectures. All three of our lecturers, very robust, lots to discuss in the question and answer session. We will not be taking questions on the sarcoma piece. Those will be answered on the RO Hub instead. So I'm going to be bouncing back and forth between prostate and GYN when I'm looking at the questions. And I think we'll start out with Dr. Nguyen about the role of radium. Do you use it and when?
So radium is something that, for the most part, our medical oncologists use. So I'm probably not the best to comment on that, but I can answer any of the other questions. Sorry, Beth, for that one.
No problem. There's quite a few here. I don't know if you have them up in front of you as well. A lot of kudos about a great lecture, so that's great to tell you. One here about genomic evaluation. Which one do you prefer? Do you have any opinions about that, the pros and cons?
Yeah.
Decipher, Oncotype, Prolaris.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely can be confusing in terms of which of these tests should be we using in which of these settings. So currently the NCCN guidelines in the upfront setting, when you're looking at biopsying patients, they have listed four tests. So the Decipher, Oncotype DX, the Prolaris cell cycle progression test, and then the ProMark test. So all of them are biopsy based. All of them give you some sense of what the outcomes might be. So they're all prognostic, but none of them so far are predictive. So I think that's important to point out right now, that everything that we know about them is that they definitely, you know, they give us a good sense of what the outcomes might be. They don't exactly tell us what the treatment is in each scenario. So in terms of the differences between the tests, you got the Oncotype DX test is looking at 17 different genes and it gives you the GPS score. ProMark is staining 8 different biomarkers. Decipher is 22 different genes, kind of a whole bunch of segments, including androgen receptor signaling, cell cycle progression. And then the Prolaris one is really focused on cell cycle progression. In terms of practicalities, all four of the tests can be used in the low and favorable intermediate setting. I think that that's, right now, that's where they're most useful. I think it's where you're trying to figure out if a patient should get active surveillance or not. And you do tests, and if the test is good, then I think you feel a lot more comfortable with active surveillance, especially if they're young or if they have a little bit more disease than you're typically comfortable with. And then if they have a bad score, then it tells you maybe you should be treating this patient. So I think in sort of that low favorable intermediate risk is pretty easy. You can use any of the four tests. They'll all give you similar kinds of information. As you move up into risk group, the thing that's new this year with NCCN is that they are allowing testing for unfavorable intermediate and high risk. This is the first time that they've said this is okay, and they've allowed it for the Decipher test as well as for the Prolaris test, which is the cell cycle progression test. This still leads to the question of what do we actually do with these test results? I think in our hearts, what we'd like to do is to say, okay, if you have intermediate risk disease and we test you and you test low, then we're not going to give hormones. If you test high, we're going to give hormones. Or if you have high risk disease and you test low, maybe we'll reduce your hormones. And if you test high, maybe we'll give you a long course. We're really not there yet, though. That's the downside. I would say I cannot recommend doing that right now. I don't think we have the data to really back that up. NRG, which was formerly RTOG, is very interested in this space and is actually trying to run trials exactly looking at that. So for high risk, they're looking at the Decipher score and whether you can use that to either shorten therapy if the score is good, or maybe you have to intensify therapy if the score is bad for high-risk patients. And then the same thing for intermediate-risk patients. They're kind of looking at, trying to look at, if you do the Decipher score and it's a good one, can you get rid of hormones if it's a bad one, and do the hormones? So I think that's still a very open question. I would not say that that's standard of care right now to do that. Actually, the one other thing I'd like to say is that the only one that works in the post-op setting right now is the Decipher score. So if you have somebody who had surgery and you're trying to figure out what's their prognosis right after surgery, then then Decipher is the one that's been tested for that.
Great, thanks. I'm sure you have a lot of patients who come armed with these results and you face this question a lot. Dr. Albuquerque, I'm going to get to you next. There is some data about margins in vulvar cancer changing. The HEAPS was 8 millimeters, and now there's some data to say that maybe those margins don't have to be quite as great. What is your thought about that, or do you still rely on the HEAPS?
Thanks, Beth. We still rely on the HEAPS data. Especially if patients have got nodal metastasis, there is an indication from the groin study and also from the AGO care study suggesting that patients who have nodal metastasis often have an increased risk of recurrence. So we strictly follow the HEAPS data and look at other factors when we decide whether we want to offer these patients adjuvant radiation therapy. In the absence of nodal metastasis, one has looked carefully at all the data to decide whether these patients need adjuvant radiation to the primary.
And there is a question about that. When, you know, if you have a patient where perhaps you're not going to treat the vulva because the margins are fine, but you're going to treat the nodes, do you ever do this where you avoid treating the vulva and just treat the nodes, or do you always treat both?
That's an excellent question and can be controversial. The general teaching is to treat the vulva because of difficulty with matching fields in the future, especially if there are other risk factors in the primary. But if there's a patient who has a very small primary, completely excised with wide margins without any other features, it may be reasonable just to leave that primary alone. Our gynecologic oncologist feels strongly about radiation in the primary site if not indicated because of some of the side effects that happen from radiation for younger patients. So in certain instances, I have not offered radiation to patients if there are no other risk factors.
Now a question for both of you. In light of the COVID-19 epidemic, are either of you changing your thoughts about treatment duration for your prostate or GYN patients? And if so, do you have some advice in which patients you might go with a more shortened course of treatment?
Sure, so I'll start with prostate. I mean, as we all know, prostate is one of those where if there's a pandemic coming, this is one of the ones where we should be least concerned about treating right away. I think for our low-risk patients, you know, especially those who are in the older group who are the most vulnerable to mortality with this disease, with the COVID-19 disease, we are definitely trying to push off the low-risk patients. As we move into treating those patients, for sure, we're looking more into hypofractionation and considering SBRT. I saw a question about if you have a favorable intermediate risk patient, are you thinking about putting them on hormones to try to push out their treatment? And I think, yes, you know, in some of these patients, we can just wait. You know, they're favorable enough that we can just hold off entirely, but certainly, if you want to make them feel a little bit better that they're getting some kind of treatment, I think a short course of hormones is very reasonable under the circumstances, especially if they're older and you know, their mortality risk from COVID would be very high. For the unfavorable intermediate risk patients where we're already committing them to hormones, maybe a 4 to 6 month course, one thing that we've been doing in our group is pushing back the time within that hormone course that we start radiation. You know, in the United States, we're very comfortable with the RTOG regimen, which is you give 2 months of hormones and then you start the radiation right at the beginning of month 3. And that's, you know, that's how we do it. But in Australia, when they did the TROG trial, so the TROG 9601 trial, which also showed a survival benefit with 6 months of hormones, there the regimen was actually to give 4 to 5 months of hormones up front and then start the radiation. So the radiation was actually started at the tail end of the hormones. And they showed very similar kinds of survival benefits. And so practically what we're doing in our group now, just to try to clear out the clinic, is we are telling those patients that we've already started the 2 months of hormone or the 6 months of hormones on, let's just put off the start of the radiation later in this course. You're not going to lose anything. The other thing that's going on, of course, is for high risk patients. So for high risk, traditionally, I very much, as you saw in the talk, I felt most comfortable with standard fractionation. I didn't really feel like there had been enough data in the proper non-inferiority trials that included high-risk patients. It was only the CHIP trial that had 6% of patients with Gleason 810 disease, and we haven't really seen it broken out. And so I tended to do the long course fractionation for high risk, but obviously in these settings, you know, in this current setting, we have to think differently. ASTRO has fully endorsed the use of moderate hypofractionation high risk. They're totally cool with it, 60 and 20 or 70 and 28. Either of those is totally fine. There's also an MD Anderson regimen that can be used. And the other thing that we have to think about is it going to get bad enough that we should even do SBRT for these high-risk patients? Now, ASTRO itself had not really endorsed SBRT for high-risk unless it's a protocol. NCCN this year said, well, you can think about SBRT for high-risk if it would be either medically or socially a problem to do conventional therapy or longer fractionation. And obviously with the COVID-19 for our very sick and older patients, especially the older patients, it is medically and socially a problem. And so NCCN has kind of opened the door to SBRT for high risk for us. In our department, we're not there yet, but I think that as this whole pandemic progresses, I think we should just keep in mind that with the NCCN guidelines now, all things are on the table. And to be fair, you know, the hypo RTPC trial did test high-risk patients with SBRT, and patients had results that were similar to conventional fractionation. The strange thing is they didn't use hormones in that trial, and so, you know, exactly how that fits in with hormones is a little bit unclear, but I think NCCN is giving us some license, especially now in this setting, to think about SBRT if things get bad.
Kevin, what are your thoughts about our cervix patients and then our endometrial patients where maybe we have a little bit more liberty to delay things?
Yeah, thanks. So for the cervix patients, it probably is difficult to hyperfractionate. One may consider omitting chemotherapy because that would reduce the immunity much more than radiation would. Maybe use a fraction strength of 2 gray per fraction and try to limit the external beam dose. Then the question of brachytherapy arises. I think there was a question about limiting the number of fractions of brachytherapy, which is reasonable. You could use 4 fractions, which is acceptable, especially from the European experience. For endometrial cancer, there has been some pilot data on using hypofractionation. There was a study that was underway, at least in an institutional setting. There's some Canadian studies going on with using 5 fractions of whole pelvic SBRT, mirroring the experience of the prostate data. And I think it's reasonable to do that for patients. They have some early experience showing that it is reasonable for patients to have this whole pelvic radiation. It's used also in rectal cancer. So that may be an option for the endometrial cancer patients.
So something like 5 gray times 5.
Yes, I think that would be
like we would do in rectal cancer pre-op. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Perhaps the two of you have some questions on your list that you would like to answer. There's quite a few. I don't know if you have had a chance to look at that list. There's quite a few on prostate. One about using space OAR, Paul, that might be something for you to address.
Yeah, sure, Beth. I'd be happy to talk about it. You know, the space OAR, I just want to say that is company that makes it is one of my disclosures on my slide. So I'm going to really stick to the data on this. So the question that I saw was, you know, what's the impact of space OAR on GI toxicity? So there was a randomized trial that was done here where they randomized patients with low and favorable intermediate risk prostate cancer, not getting hormones. All of them got external beam radiation to, I think it was 7920. And they randomized them 2-1 where 2 got the spacer and 1 didn't. And basically when you looked at the 3-year results, they had a few outcomes. First, the physician reported toxicity. So the 3-year incidence of grade 1 physician reported GI toxicity decreased from 9.2% to 2%. And then the grade 2 or higher GI toxicity reduced from 5.7% to 0% if you had the spacer. So that was the physician-reported toxicity. Dan Hamstra went back and did an analysis then of the patient-reported quality of life. And that's where the data showed a bigger difference in the GI outcomes. And I think we all know that there is a difference between physician-reported and patient-reported outcomes. And so when they looked at the three-year patient-reported quality of life, difference in the patients who had a sort of a clinically significant decline in bowel quality of life was 41% in the control arm versus 14% when the space was added. And when they looked at patients who had a very big drop in bowel quality of life, that was 21% in the control arm versus 5% with the spacer. So I think that the data with the patient-reported quality of life speaks to a larger effect than what was seen with the physician-reported quality of life. There were some questions about technically, how should you do this? And, you know, are you using, what are you doing to plan with it? And are you using contrast? So currently, you know, for those of you who have used Space OAR, the material on a CT scan often looks kind of similar to the rectum, often looks kind of similar to the prostate. If you look at them enough, you can make it out. And sometimes you can make it out better than others. A lot of folks, I think about half the folks in the country that are using this right now are using MRI in addition to the CT scan. So not that they're sending them for an MRI sim, but that they are getting an MRI to help guide them, essentially, because on an MRI, you can see the material very clearly. You can see exactly where you've placed your material versus where the prostate and where the rectum is. And so I think that allows for much better contouring. And so if you can, then I think the MRI is very helpful when you're using Space OAR in terms of planning. So just to have a side-by-side MRI or an MRI that you can use so you can really see the boundary between the prostate, the spacer, and the rectum, and then kind of get the most use out of it. There was a question about, you know, do you inject contrast into that? Currently, you know, that would be something that people might be doing on their own, but that's currently not on label. I don't inject contrast into it. I either try my best to see it on a CT scan or I do an MRI at the same time so that I can try to fuse them.
Great. Kevin, do you have a question you want to address? Otherwise, I have a couple.
There are two questions on the GOG 258, I think, which is a very topical questions. And the issue is, your gynecologic oncologist feels that radiation is not indicated anymore for patients because of the results. And that's a struggle that I have, and I don't know, I'm sure people are having in their practices where because of the results of the GOG 258, the feeling is that chemotherapy is going to solve all the issues and radiation is not indicated anymore. I would like to point out that there was a significant amount of failure, and that was almost 30% recurrence rate for patients who had chemotherapy alone in the pelvis as well as in the periodic region, which is significant for patient morbidity. And this is something that we need to discuss aggressively with our gynecologic oncologist, because once you have a recurrence, you need much more treatment to control that recurrence with a lot of more morbidity. While with modern IMRT, the toxicity of radiation is quite low. The toxicities that were mentioned in POTEC 1 with patients having incontinence, et cetera, are hardly seen in our patients on long-term follow-up. And hopefully the TIME-C study on long-term follow-up will reveal those findings to us. So I strongly advocate for radiation if we can, particularly for patients with parametrial involvement or adnexal involvement, margins, et cetera. And I think one has to be able to advocate for radiation to see the role of radiation in the settings.
Another question that's closely related is the sequencing. There's a lot of discussion about sequential, you know, chemo first, radiation last, sandwich. Do you have any feel about that with your in-depth analysis of these issues and within your practice?
So that's a good question also. And I think one of the findings from the GOG 258 was that patients who had chemo radiation did not complete all the chemotherapy cycles. And so there was a concern that maybe they were not treated adequately. We have some retrospective sandwich data. I think it's not clear what is the best way of giving treatments, but there is an analysis of the National Cancer Database looking at chemotherapy given early followed by radiation, suggesting that that may be the best route. Certainly that would be one way of getting radiation for our patients, because following the breast cancer paradigm, if there's a high risk of patients for recurrence, particularly stage 3C2 patients, one may want to give chemotherapy first, following that with radiation. And that may be the best way to get radiation for the patients and avoiding them having some recurrences either the parotid region or the pelvic region.
It would be nice to have a trial that would look at all the sequencing issues, but I suspect that will never be the case.
No,
I yeah. Great. We'll go back to prostate. Paul, what about other questions that you might want to, before we, I guess we have about 13 minutes yet.
Yeah, sure. So let me just take a look here at, the questions that folks have asked. So one that got voted up a lot was, when we're talking about the doses, are we talking about doses to an isocenter or to a volume? And basically all of these doses we're talking about now are to volume. There were a few trials, like the MD Anderson dose escalation trial that looked at doses to isocenter from escalating from 70 gray to 78 gray. The old R2G trials, when they presented their doses of like 66 gray, for example, in R2G 9408, that was a dose to an isocenter. But when we're talking now about the modern dose escalation era, all those doses are to the PTV. So the 79.2 gray, for example, comes from the PROG 9505 trial, first author was Anthony Zeitman, and they prescribed to a PTV. And so that's kind of the basis for all these doses. Now, another question was, what margins are we using for hypofractionated radiation? In our center, we're using still, we've got fiducials in there, so we're still using 5 millimeters all around with daily image guidance.
And do you sim your patients with MRI or with CT? Does that make a difference?
Yes. So, in our department, we recently got an MRI sim. And so what we've been doing is, I've planned on CTs my entire life. And so actually doing this with MRI sim is kind of new for me. But basically for patients with intact prostate, we're sending them for a regular CT sim. And then on the same day, we're sending them to the MRI scanner, which is MRI sim lined up with the same lasers so they can line up the tattoos. And then we're fusing those to allow for contouring. And our department is kind of in transition where we're interested in trying to move over to an MRI only stimulation. I think one of the issues that we're all grappling with as we transfer from CT based to MRI only planning is that I think we all know that when you contour a prostate based on a CT scan, you're generally over contouring. You can't exactly see the margins that well, and so you always add a little bit here and there. With the MR, we're going to be able to perfectly see the outline of the prostate, and so our volumes may very well get smaller. And I think one of the concerns that I have in the back of my mind, and I think many of us do, is if we're just contouring that prostate that we see on MRI and we contour it perfectly, are we going to wind up essentially having a smaller volume and possibly leaving out some microscopic disease that we used to cover by accident just because we contoured more widely? So I think that's going to be one of the big questions as we move over as we start incorporating MRI more into our planning. But right now I would say CT is still the standard. People do MRI fusions when they can, but CT is still where it's, most of the planning is happening.
Kevin, there was a question about adding vaginal cuff brachytherapy boost following external beam for a patient with cervix cancer. I guess, would there be a difference if they've had a radical hysterectomy versus just a THBSO? And in what settings do you do that boost postoperatively?
Yeah. So there's no real data for the use of a vaginal cuff boost following a radical hysterectomy, though I believe many radiation oncologists still do that. And in fact, some of the clinical trials that are out there, the RTOG studies still leave it up to the practicing radiation oncologists to add the boost, vaginal cuff boost. However, for patients with positive margins, I would advocate using the vaginal boost. And also if the patient had an incidental hysterectomy where the prior diagnosis of cervical cancer was not made and the operation was less than a radical hysterectomy, then there may be an indication for adding the vaginal cuff boost for that patient just to get the dose to the vaginal cuff appropriately.
Great, that's helpful. Paul, how do you feel the discussion of protons versus photons for prostate cancer?
Sure. I think I'm still very open and agnostic about it right now. I think, of course, we are awaiting the one randomized trial, which is being run out of MGH, and many other centers across the country are participating. I know Penn has put a lot of patients on at University of Washington, many different centers. So that's the one randomized trial that's going to tell us about quality of life between protons and photons. So until that trial comes out, I've been very agnostic. I certainly, I'm happy for patients to get referred and meet with a radiation oncologist who has protons if they want to talk about it. But I would say that for the most part, patients are happy knowing that the current data would not tell us that there's a difference at this time. I don't think we have good evidence to back to say there's a quality of life difference or a control difference at this time. And we're waiting for the randomized trial, which is getting, I think, very close to accrued. And we should have good data then, within 15 months of accrual. So I'm very excited for that data to come out. I think that's going to answer a lot of questions. Because we've been talking about the same thing for the last 10 years now for randomized trial to answer that data. So stay tuned for that one.
Kevin, this is a twister. How do you interpret no LVSI in an endometrial cancer patient in the presence of isolated tumor cells in a node? It seems like something's missing there.
Right. So that's an interesting question. And actually, I presented a paper by Plante et al. Who looked at the ITCs and the micrometastasis in a prospective fashion. In fact, it's one of the only prospective series. And what they did there was they found that there was a certain percentage of patients who had no lymph LVI and had ITCs. I think it was about 20%. They did not treat the patients with ITC with adjuvant therapy for the most part. And regardless of whether they had LVSI or not, they mostly did quite well. And the current recommendation, in fact, the NCCN doesn't make a direct recommendation, but they refer to this paper. And from this paper, the authors concluded that there was no indication to treat patients with adjuvant therapy if they had ITCs. LVSI by itself is, while it's a risk factor, one has to look at that in the totality of all the other risk factors to determine whether that patient needs adjuvant therapy. If you remember the ESMO classification that I alluded to, grade 1 and 2 patients with LVSI were considered high intermediate risk, and they did not need chemotherapy or other treatments. So those patients really should be treated according to the other risk factors. So LVI is not essential for ITCs, and while it may be a contradiction, I think one has to look at all the features and then decide how to treat them.
So you'd add on deep myometrial invasion, grade, just because they have ITCs doesn't mean you wouldn't treat them. But if they had some of these other risk factors, then you might treat them.
That's correct.
Yes. I think it's such a moving target for all of us and makes you a bit nervous not to treat somebody with ITC. Evidence. All right, let's go back to Paul. Paul, you have a lot of questions on your list.
Yeah, so I'll go to the next highest scored one, I guess. So the next question is about regional nodal disease and what patient scheme do we use and what dose do I take involved nodes to? So basically for the uninvolved pelvis, I'm going to 50.4 gray in 28 fractions, so 1.8 gray each. And if somebody has an involved node, then I'm going to boost that involved node to at least 2.2 gray per fraction in that same 28 fraction scheme. So that goes to 61.6 gray. The next question was, how do I treat a patient who has control in the prostate but has oligometastatic disease involving a bone and a node? Well, this is interesting. So basically the prostate is controlled. So let's say, for example, they've had a radical prostatectomy and maybe you've treated with salvage radiation to the prostate fossa before, and now they have an oligometastatic recurrence in a node, which you haven't treated the pelvis, and they've got one in the bone. For me, I would kind of look at how healthy that patient is. If the patient is super young, and you know, we do run into this. I've run into patients in their early 50s with this kind of scale. In that case, I try to swing for the fences. So basically, I try to make up for not having treated the nodes by treating the entire pelvis. I know some people might just do SBRT to that one node, but you know, I think if you've got a 50-year-old and you're really thinking they've recurred in one node, they've probably recurred in some other nodes too. So I tend to treat the whole pelvis. I boost that node, and then I do SBRT to the bony lesion.
Very good. Well, we are almost out of time. I want to thank both of you for your excellent lectures, for all the time and effort that you put into preparing these for all of us, and for being with us on a Sunday when we're all shut in. You've brought us something wonderful to think about in these challenging days. So stay well, both of you and everyone else, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Beth.
Thank you.